I don't think I've ever seen anyone come back like this, a doctor told Beverly. I don't want to raise your hopes, but this is amazing. Beverly, however, remained concerned. In the rehab hospital, it became clear that the disease had changed her husband in unsettling ways. Eugene couldn't remember which day of the week it was, for instance, or the names of his doctors and nurses, no matter how many times they introduced themselves. Why do they keep asking me all these questions? He asked Beverly one day after a physician left his room. When he finally returned home, things got even stranger. Eugene didn't seem to remember their friends. He had trouble following conversations. Some mornings, he would get out of bed, walk into the kitchen, cook himself bacon and eggs, then climb back under the covers and turn on the radio. 40 minutes later, he would do the same thing. Get up, cook bacon and eggs, climb back into bed, and fiddle with the radio. Then, he would do it again. Alarmed, Beverly reached out to specialists, including a researcher at the University of California, San Diego, who specialized in memory loss. Which is how, on a sunny fall day, Beverly and Eugene found themselves in a nondescript building on the university's campus, holding hands as they walked slowly down a hallway. They were shown into a small exam room. Eugene began chatting with a young woman who was using a computer. Having been in electronics over the years, I'm amazed at all this, he said, gesturing at the machine she was typing on. When I was younger, that thing would have been in a couple of 6-foot racks and taken up this whole room. The woman continued pecking at the keyboard. Eugene chuckled. That is incredible, he said. All those printed circuits and diodes and triodes. When I was in electronics, there would have been a couple of 6-foot racks holding that thing. A scientist entered the room and introduced himself. He asked Eugene how old he was. Oh, let's see. 59 or 60? Eugene replied. He was 71 years old. The scientist started typing on the computer. Eugene smiled and pointed at it. That is really something, he said. You know, when I was in electronics, there would have been a couple of 6-foot racks holding that thing. The scientist was 52-year-old Larry Squire, a professor who had spent the past 3 decades studying the neuroanatomy of memory. His specialty was exploring how the brain stores events. His work with Eugene, however, would soon open a new world to him and hundreds of other researchers who have reshaped our understanding of how habits function. Squire's studies would show that even someone who can't remember his own age, or almost anything else, can develop habits that seem inconceivably complex, until you realize that everyone relies on similar neurological processes every day. His and others' research would help reveal the subconscious mechanisms that impact the countless choices that seem as if they're the products of well-reasoned thought, but actually are influenced by urges most of us barely recognize or understand. By the time Squire met Eugene, he had already been studying images of his brain for weeks. The scans indicated that almost all the damage within Eugene's skull was limited to a 5-centimeter area near the center of his head. The virus had almost entirely destroyed his medial temporal lobe, a sliver of cells which scientists suspected was responsible for all sorts of cognitive tasks, such as recall of the past and the regulation of some emotions. The completeness of the destruction didn't surprise Squire. Viral encephalitis consumes tissue with a ruthless, almost surgical precision. What shocked him was how familiar the images seemed. 30 years earlier, as a PhD student at MIT, Squire had worked alongside a group studying a man known as H.M., one of the most famous patients in medical history. When H.M., His real name was Henry Molaison, but scientists shrouded his identity throughout his life, was 7 years old. He was hit by a bicycle and landed hard on his head. Soon afterward, he developed seizures and started blacking out. At 16, he had his first grand mal seizure, the kind that affects the entire brain. Soon, he was losing consciousness up to 10 times a day. By the time he turned 27, H.M. was desperate. Anticonvulsive drugs hadn't helped. He was smart, but couldn't hold a job. He still lived with his parents. H.M. wanted a normal existence. So he sought help from a physician whose tolerance for experimentation outweighed his fear of malpractice. Studies had suggested that an area of the brain called the hippocampus might play a role in seizures. When the doctor proposed cutting into H.M.'s head, lifting up the front portion of his brain, and with a small straw, sucking out the hippocampus and some surrounding tissue from the interior of his skull, H.M. gave his consent. The surgery occurred in 1953, and as H.M. healed, his seizures slowed. Almost immediately, however, it became clear that his brain had been radically altered. H.M. knew his name and that his mother was from Ireland. He could remember the 1929 stock market crash and news reports about the invasion of Normandy. But almost everything that came afterward, all the memories, experiences, and struggles for most of the decade before his surgery, had been erased. When a doctor began testing H.M.'s memory by showing him playing cards and lists of numbers, he discovered that H.M. couldn't retain any new information for more than 20 seconds or so. From the day of his surgery until his death in 2008, every person H.M. met, every song he heard, every room he entered, was a completely fresh experience. His brain was frozen in time. Each day, he was befuddled by the fact that someone could change the television channel by pointing a black rectangle of plastic at the screen. He introduced himself to his doctors and nurses over and over, dozens of times each day.